From News Talk 580 1059 KMJ, this is the Maddie Report, Valley Views Edition. Here is Mark Kepler.
This week on the Maddie Report, Valley Views Edition.
Each year, the governor and the legislature set forth the upcoming year's priorities through the state budget. Unlike in years past, however, this year's state finances are shaping up to have a budget surplus. The infusion of new revenue has changed the debate, from a discussion of what programs to cut to whether a growing surplus should be used to restore those cuts or retire the state's debts. But is the current projected surplus something we can take to the bank? What does the state's near and long-term budget picture actually look like? We'll ask. Mac Taylor, the leader of the state's nonpartisan Legislative Analyst Office, or the LAO.
We'll also hear from Paul Hurley, former editorial page editor for the Visalia Times Delta, California State University Fresno political science professor Jeff Cummins, and UC Merced political science professor Nate Monroe.
The current California budget surplus, trick or treat?
Additional funding for the Maddie Report made possible by a grant from Paramount Agricultural Companies, growing healthy food for you and your family.
From the California Channel at the state capitol, Valley PBS and the Maddie Institute, it's the Maddie Report with executive director of the Maddie Institute, Mark Kepler.
Welcome. Our guest is Mac Taylor, the California's legislative analyst and the state's leading authority on the budget. Welcome back to the Maddie Report, Mac.
Nice to be back, Mark.
So, generally, how does the state budget look over the next couple of years?
Well, you know, I've been on this show during the really bad years of 2008 to 2012, so it's nice to come on when the state's budget situation is in much better shape.
I remember when we were talking about this a few years ago, and you were saying that you saw $20 billion deficits as far as the eye could see.
They were even higher than that. Mm. So I'm glad to report that the budget is in much better shape. Our spending is generally in line with incoming revenues, and there's actually money left over to build up reserves and continue to pay off some of the debts that we've incurred. So it's a much, much better situation than we've seen in a long time.
So you're actually projecting a surplus, aren't you?
Yes, although it really goes to how we build our forecast. We just came out with a report that we put out every November.
Let me get a little plug here for the LAO. If you want to know about what's going on in the state budget, I strongly encourage you to go on the website and take a look at their reports. They're very well done.
And this was our fiscal outlook, in which we sort of the kicking off point for the next budget season, the 2015-16 budget, that will begin next July 1. And it's very important, the assumptions that we make in giving those numbers.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that.
What we do is basically we assume that the current commitments that the legislature has made, its spending commitments, continue on in the near future.
Well, there's a subtle point you're trying to, I think, make here, and that is no new commitments.
That's right. And it's not to say there shouldn't be any commitments. It's just that that's for the legislature and the governor to decide. Mm-hmm. All we can do is say, well, if you continue your current spending sort of practices and you take our revenue estimates, these are the numbers that would result from that.
It's interesting when you said that, because I was doing a little research, and I found that Senate President Pro Tem Kevin DeLeon said the legislature needs to, quote, make prudent and wise investments to continue building the state's economic strength, which sounds to me like they may want to be adding some things in the budget, but this is a balancing act.
Exactly. Yeah. And the purpose of our report is to kind of give them the lay of the land and show them what do they have to play with. Are their numbers in balance? Can they add new spending commitments, or do they need to cut back on others? And it just depends on some key decisions that they'll have to make.
And a lot of times it seems like when you're looking at the budget, a big source of the revenue, we're going to talk about this in a little bit, is our personal income taxes, and a big source of that are capital gains, which are highly volatile. It's kind of hard to predict.
They're very hard to predict. Certainly in the near term, we know that markets are at all-time high, and we would expect very good capital gain numbers, and we've been seeing that. And so you can expect revenues to be doing very well given where the markets are. But that can turn around really quickly.
Anybody who has a 403B, has stuff invested in the market, those few years that were great, and then it dips down, and then it's good again, realizes how volatile the market can be.
And it's a big part of our revenue structure.
Yeah. Well, Prop 98 is the state's constitutional funding guarantee for schools. And the way it's calculated, the way I understand it, is the higher state revenues are, the more goes to school funding. What does that mean for the upcoming budget?
Well, it is complicated because on average, schools get about 40% of the total budget. But at the margin, they can get a lot more or a lot less. It kind of depends on where you are. In the current fiscal year, for example, we're estimating that the state is going to have $2 billion more than we thought we were going to have this year when the budget was passed. Now, interestingly enough, we estimate that all of that money will go to schools. just because of the way that we are implementing the formulas. So even though all of the groups out there probably think, well, there's more money for us, all of it's going to schools, which is great for schools, mm-hmm. but there's really not money left over for other spending commitments or to build up reserves.
Yeah, I think I've heard it described, the formula, a Prop 98 formula, as something akin to the Winchester Mystery House.
Well, it is a little bit like that. There are lots of different formulas that we've had different interpretations of them, and it's very unintuitive. So you really just have to play through the numbers and see what they spit out.
People have said that there are a few people who designed Prop 98 have actually put their kids through college explaining Prop 98. So your report says that there's going to be a $4.2 billion reserve in 15-16. How did you arrive at that conclusion?
Well, and again, what we said is at the end of 15-16, if all of those assumptions we talked about, if our revenue estimates come about, and you just stick with your current spending commitments, this is what would be at the end result of that, you would have $4.2 billion in reserves that you could use to cushion any future downfalls. Now, again, we're not predicting that that's what the state will have, because as you say, some people want to spend more. So I think that really points to the key issue. Is $4.2 billion enough in reserves? If it is, and you want to spend more, then you have to make some adjustments elsewhere. If you think it's too much, you don't need that much money in reserves, then you can make additional spending commitments without making other decisions.
I think a lot of people, it's interesting, you know, a million here, a million there. Yeah. To most regular folks, that's a lot of money. But for the state budget, it's not. And we're talking about, how big is the state budget? Put it in context.
The general fund budget is about $108 billion. So we're talking about less than 4% if you kept that 4.2. It's a lot of money. But think about your own personal finances, how easy it is for something to swing, and a 4% reserve is not bad, but given how volatile our revenue structure is, I'm not sure that's enough.
It's interesting, a lot of companies want to keep a reserve of 5 to 10% for those rainy days, and we're going to talk about that in a little bit. So as the economy goes, so goes state revenue. So what is the state of the state's economy going forward? We're talking to Mac Taylor, head of the nonpartisan California Legislative Analyst Office. So as you analyze future state revenues, what are the overall trends you're projecting for the United States generally and for California specifically?
Well, both pretty similar, and they have been for the last 2 or 3 years. As we've come out of the recession, we've had basically fairly moderate growth. We've never had that sort of gangbuster year that we might have in past recessions where you pop back really quickly and have very rapid increases in personal income and revenues. So we've had sort of moderate growth.
So when you say moderate growth, it's been running, what, 4%?
Well, personal income, and it's a notion that's used for state. Mm-hmm. That's most of your economy is what people earn. Maybe growing at 4.5%.
And when you say robust, as
that
in
could
other...
be 7 or 8 or 9% in okay. some years coming out of recessions.
Okay.
So we're doing fine. It's sort of moderate growth, and we're actually forecasting in the next couple of years it will accelerate, get a little bit faster. But in general, continued moderate growth at both the United States level and at California's level.
Now, you were saying, I think, in your report that this is the sixth year of an expansion. Is that, how long do expansions usually last?
About 5 to 6 years,
okay.
on average.
Heads up.
On average. And again, we're not forecasting that we are going to turn down in the very near future. There's still slack in the economy. Unemployment is still relatively high, mm-hmm. Particularly in the Central Valley.
Right.
So we think that the economy still has room to grow, but it is a warning sign when you think about the state's budgetary situation of why it's so important to build up reserves in anticipation of some downturn in the future.
You just think about that. You're in the stock market. It's been going up and up and up. And
all-time highs.
Right. People think it's going to go on forever. Or just like the housing. A lot of people thought the housing market would continue, and of course it didn't. Well, one area, speaking of which, where the economy really took a hit was in housing during the recession. What do you see as the trends now in housing in California?
The last couple of years, prices have really rebounded, primarily in the coastal areas, but basically throughout the state. They've grown very rapidly, in fact. And you would think that generally when you have high prices, it's a strong signal to home builders that we would be having a sort of a burst of construction. And that's typically a very important contributor to economic growth. That's one of the reasons why you can bounce back very quickly.
And just explain that, the reason why.
Well,
is
you build houses, not only do you get that boost of putting construction workers and people back to work, what happens when someone moves into a new house?
You need a refrigerator.
You need the appliances, the carpeting, the furniture, the yard-related materials and things, and it can really give you a nice boost. So we're not seeing that building. In fact, we've actually lowered some of our housing permits, both single-family and multifamily, somewhat since last year. And it's a little bit of a puzzle. Two possible explanations. One, home builders are just more hesitant about not getting too far out on spec homes, et cetera. The second thing is household formations are not growing. Household formations mean someone leaves the nest, someone leaves the home and sets up their own apartment. Either people are sticking around with the parents a little longer or the roommates are staying together. And when you don't have that household formation, you don't have that sort of demand that, generates the supply.
Yeah. Let's talk about the general fund revenues. In general, your report indicates there's likely to be a $2 billion of revenues above projections.
In the current year,
which we're now in. Right. And the biggest source of general fund revenues, two-thirds, come from personal income taxes. So some of those sources of personal income tax are pretty stable, wages and things like that. Other sources, like capital gains we're talking about, are quite volatile. How did you arrive at your wage and capital gains projections?
Well, and it's good that you point out the personal income tax. We used to think of the state having three major taxes, the big three. Really, we have the big one now. Personal income taxes are two-thirds of
What were the other two of the big three?
Corporate taxes and the sales and use tax.
Okay, so now
the sales tax.
Personal income tax.
Personal income is the big one. It's two-thirds. And you're right. A wage income, just people that get their salaries, they don't tend to change a lot from year to year. There's not a lot of volatility in that. That's relatively easy to forecast. If you know what the economy's doing, you kind of know what wage income is going to do. The capital gains is obviously heavily dependent not only on the financial markets, the stock market, but also on housing markets, like we just talked about, prices going up rapidly or can come down rapidly. And so estimating capital gains is very difficult to do, particularly in the longer run.
You know, I think it was kind of interesting when I was reading your report, I think it was in your report, it was saying that capital gains projections are $12 billion. And if you take a look at the state budget, which is about $112 billion, 10% of the state budget, approximately, is capital gains. That's a big part.
And it's paid primarily by high-income taxpayers who pay at the very highest marginal tax rates, and they generate, the top 1% of people generate over half of our personal income taxes.
That's substantial. Well, another source we were talking about a moment ago was the sales and use taxes. They bring in about $22 billion into the state budget. How much are they expected to grow?
You know, we have sales taxes growing, you know, moderately well, sort of with, we were talking about revenues growing at maybe underlying revenues growing at 4.5%, and sales taxes are humming along at a fairly moderate rate.
You know, you've got Prop 30, which had added a quarter cent sales tax. That's going to end in 2016. What impact is that going to have on revenues?
Well, you know, you have the sales tax ending in 16, and you have the personal income tax rates ending in 2018. And so I think you heard a lot of people talking about what happens when Prop 13 triggers off. Are we going to have this big cliff effect where revenues fall off? But because they're going off at different times, they have the effect of phasing out over four fiscal years. And so it really just results in slower growth each year.
Pumping the brakes.
It's very gradual, and I think that was a very smart thing because you don't really have these major cliff effects.
We're talking with Mac Taylor, California's nonpartisan legislative analyst and the authoritative voice on the state budget. So we've talked about state revenues. Let's talk about state spending. Now, people are sometimes surprised to learn that education represents the biggest state of the state budget, biggest expense of the state budget, around 40 to 50%. Pretty substantial. So your projections for education spending in the budget are what?
Well, 40% roughly is for K-12 and community colleges. And
then you got to add UC and CSU on top of that.
And the only reason we separated out is because you got the Prop 98 funding formula that tends to determine what we spend on the community colleges and K-12, whereas the universities and financial aid, the legislature has a lot more discretion over what it spends for that. With regard to the universities and financial aid, we have it growing actually pretty substantially. We assume that the legislature would continue to fund along the lines of what the governor has proposed, 4% increases throughout the period. That's just an assumption, obviously, that can change. On Prop 98, it continues to do, it does very well in 14-15 and in 15-16. It has a lot of new ongoing resources. It probably does better than any other segment of the budget. After that, in the out years, it doesn't grow as rapidly, in part because of those Proposition 30 revenues triggering off, but it still has $2.5 billion of growth each year.
We've got the Prop 30 taxes, the temporary taxes. People are wondering if they really are temporary, but allegedly temporary taxes phasing out over the next few years. But meanwhile, you've got some things phasing in, like the local control funding formula and the increased cost for CalSTRS, those rate increases that are paying for teacher pensions. What is the effect of all of this on the state budget?
Well, the local control funding formula and the increases have to be handled within whatever the minimum guarantee is. So if the money's available, you can go faster in sort of getting to the targets that you the legislature set out under that new funding formula. And then the CalSTRS or state teachers retirement system increases. The schools are going to have to bear a quite significant increase in costs related to that. We're estimating, for example, that between this current year and the end of our forecast period, 2019-20, that the schools will have over $11 billion more in annual funding by the end of that period.
Wow.
That seems like a lot, and it's a pretty good increase. Mm-hmm. Within that, they're going to have to absorb over $3 billion in just additional costs related to the state teacher system. So that's taking a chunk of their growth, but they still have quite a bit of new resources that they'll have to spend.
You know, let's kind of turn our attention to higher education for a second. A lot of talk about tuition hikes at UC, University of California. What are the implications for the state budget if those tuition hikes go forward? And what are the implications for the state budget if they don't go forward?
Well, the easier one is if they don't go forward. You had the governor of the legislature, at least last year, had said, we want to have these annual increases, but no tuition increases. So if they don't go forward, the legislature and the governor can just fund UC however it wants to, whether it's at those levels of 4% a year or whatever amount it wants. If they go through with the increase or propose to increase tuition, it's not clear what happens. The legislature could just fund them as they were going to fund them, and then UC could impose the tuition, and the system would have more money, right? Because the two sources of funding our instructional programs at the University of California are tuitions, paid by families and students, and general fund money.
Okay, but they could also do a zero-sum situation. If UC gets more money through tuitions, the state could say, maybe less money we appropriate to the legislature.
They could certainly do that.
So you're at zero.
Then you're at zero as far as the overall system is concerned.
Right.
But if the legislature wants to exert its control, that would, in fact, be an option. So it's a little hard to say if they do go through with it, what happens.
We don't know at
we
this
don't
point.
Know.
Okay, politics. Another thing I want to talk about was the significant expansion in Medi-Cal brought about by the Affordable Care Act. How is that going to impact the state budget?
You know, surprisingly, not as much as one might think. A lot of the expansion was to low-income adults, and the federal government right now is paying the entire cost of that. So there's not really a hit on the budget. Now, we are experiencing some costs because people that we have to pay half of the health care cost on, those numbers are growing because of Obamacare, federal health care reform. But the feds are also giving us some greater money for some children who are low-income, and so the budgetary effect is surprising, not as much as some people might imagine.
Okay. What about CalWORKs? And a lot of people refer to that as welfare, another name for welfare. General improvement in the economy, things are doing better. So shouldn't those costs be going down?
We certainly have that in our fiscal outlook, Mark, that if you look on our out years, they go down by, I think, on average, 10% a year from the high that we've experienced in this last year to 1920. So we do have, we reflect our estimates of continued economic growth, more people would come off the rolls.
Okay, let's talk about corrections and rehabilitation. You got realignment going on. You've got the passage of Prop 47 in November, which reduced some nonviolent crimes, felonies to misdemeanors. What impact on state spending?
Well, Proposition 47, which the people just approved, will probably lower our state prison costs by a couple hundred million dollars a year beginning next year. So not a dramatic effect on a $9 billion budget. But if you do look at our estimates for the out years, our prison-related costs grow very slowly, in part because you have those offsetting savings from things like Proposition 47 and realignment.
In November, the voters passed Prop 2, a more restrictive and robust rainy day fund. What are the short and long-term implications? We're talking to Mac Taylor, head of the Nonpartisan Legislative Analyst Office. So what were some of the key changes brought about by the passage of Prop 2?
Well, every year requires monies to be set aside in order to pay off debts and build up reserves. And there's kind of two pieces of those set-asides. There's an automatic 1.5% of revenues, so about $1.5 billion each year. And then there's an amount that's dependent on whether we're doing very well on capital gains. So you talked about this volatile revenue source. When they're above average, we take more money off the table and we put it into this pot and we divide it with those 1.5% of revenues. You take both of them together and you spend half on reserves, half on paying down debts.
Okay. Well, you indicated, though, there's going to be some key choices that are going to have to be made as it, when it comes to implementing Prop 2. One of them has to do with this $1.6 billion that was deposited in the Rainy Day Fund for 14-15, but may or may not be covered by Prop 2 on these more restrictive rules. What do you think should be done with the money?
Well, it is kind of a technical issue on whether the rules of Proposition 2 apply to it or whether the legislature has a little more flexibility over the control of it. But I think you raised the more important issue. You remember that $4.2 billion number we talked about earlier about the reserve that we're forecasting?
Right.
The 1.6 is part of that. And so whether you have a lot of control or you're more limited, we think that you should shoot for that $4.2 billion reserve because we think it's going to be needed.
Now that wall of debt's, you know, kind of taking care of those issues that need to be filled.
But this 4.2 is more your reserve that you would use to protect against a downturn in revenues.
Okay,
It's not for the debt. That's another whole other pot of money.
Okay. Well, you've stated in your report, quote, by using the Prop 2 debt payment funds to tackle large persistent debts over the next 15 years, the state's policymakers can ensure more budget flexibility for the general fund in the long term, unquote. So what kinds of debts are eligible? Let's talk about that for Prop 2.
Well, Proposition 2 that the voters just approved last month was very specific. You can pay off certain budgetary liabilities, like we've made some special fund loans. We've had some monies that we owe local governments for state mandates. And the biggest piece, though, is unfunded liabilities related to any retirement-related benefits.
And those have been substantial. People have talked about that for years.
Tens of billions of dollars.
Yeah. Okay. I've also read that you're suggesting that the legislature develop a plan for the use of Prop 2 funds. How novel. A plan. So what should the plan look like?
Well, there's no one right plan, Mark, I think. But you have 15 years where, on average, you could have $2.5 billion a year. Mm-hmm. And so we're just suggesting that you approach this a little more methodically than just on a year-to-year ad hoc basis. For example, the one retirement liability that we're not addressing at all is our state retiree health benefits. It's completely pay-as-you-go. And we're suggesting that the legislature might want to give that high priority of using some of those, maybe 13 years worth of those debt payments, to really make important inroads in getting our retiree health liabilities addressed.
So explain for folks, why is pay-as-you-go not a good idea? You're paying it. But why is it not really as effective and efficient as putting money aside?
Well, there's sort of the generational issue of you have people that had the service being provided by those employees, and they're having their children and future generations pay for them. That's not good public policy. But it's also very expensive. When you pay as the benefits are accrued, you can put it into a fund that earns interest, and then it's much less expensive over time. So we think that we should go, just as we do for pension programs, we should go to a funded system, and this debt scheme that we have under Prop 2 might allow us to build up enough money to pay off most of those unfunded liabilities.
So I think the key point is that you want the money to work for you, and if you set some money aside, you can get some interest on that money, and it actually makes it less expensive to pay that benefit.
Exactly.
So it's short-term, pay me now or pay me later.
And it, obviously, if you pay it for those liabilities, they're not available for other things that many members of the legislature would like to spend on.
Yeah, you know, looking at your budget report, it's obviously very challenging to put together a long-term, budget outlook. And you've got to focus on different kinds of scenarios. So what are the kinds of scenarios that you look at when you're trying to make this determination?
Well, we sort of do a main economic scenario, which is based on sort of continued moderate growth throughout. But we realize that that's just one of many possible outcomes. And so in order to help the legislature, we did a alternative hypothetical slowdown. And what we said is, what if in 2016 the market dropped by 20% and you had some economic slowdown? Not a recession, just a slowdown. And whereas we were predicting surpluses, operating surpluses of $4 billion a year, again on that $107 billion base in the general fund, that turns into operating deficits of a couple of billion a year.
Mm-hmm.
And the reserves that we would build up, that $4.2 billion, could help you get by for a year. But then it turns into negative operating deficits. And that's why it's so important, in our view, to build up those reserves as high as possible.
What if there's a surge, though? What if there's a revenue surge?
Well, we also think that we could get more capital gains money right now than what is assumed under our main economic scenario. And ironically, because that bumps up your Proposition 98 on an ongoing basis where it's more of a temporary surge, you actually end up in slightly worse condition than under our main economic scenario.
It's counterintuitive when you think about it. But I want to thank Mac Taylor from the Legislative Analyst's Office for being with us today.
Up next,
What impact will the state's improving finances have on the Valley? We'll talk to Fresno State political science professor Jeff Cummins, Paul Hurley, the former editorial page editor of the Visalia Times-Delta, and UC Merced political science professor Nate Monroe.
From News Talk 580 1059 KMJ, this is the Matty Report, Valley Views Edition. Here is Mark Kepler.
Welcome back. So what does the governor's budget mean for the San Joaquin Valley? We've got three points of view on that question. UC Merced political science professor Nate Monroe. Welcome, Professor Monroe.
Thank you.
Paul Hurley, the former editorial page editor for the Visalia Times-Delta. Welcome, Paul.
Thanks for having me, Mark.
And California State University political science professor Jeff Cummins. Welcome, Professor Cummins.
Thank you, Mark.
So, Professor Cummins, we'll start with you first. Let's begin our discussion with some of the Valley's immediate needs. One is education. The Valley has long suffered from low educational attainment and high dropout rates. And it's clear from our discussion with Mac Taylor, the state's legislative analyst, that because of Prop 98, the lion's share of the state's improving finances are going to be directed toward K through 12 education. And given, you know, this new local control funding formula where they're putting K through 12 money to schools that have a high number of low income or English as a second language students, that appears to be probably a significant increase for funding for Valley schools. The question is, will all that extra money result in improved educational attainment? What do you think?
Well, I would say we'll see some incremental improvement. I would say, though, what really matters is whether or not the funding becomes consistent. It's hard for the school districts to really put in place a good education system, and in particular hire the most effective teachers, if they don't know if that funding is going to be consistent. So to the extent that just the state and then the Valley will also benefit, the state brings in consistent revenue over the next 3 years, I would say that, you know, that would help improve it the most. But I think the other thing you have to remember is that while you can put more money into hiring teachers and everything, one of the problems with low-income areas and English as a second language students is the support at home isn't always there, and so it's hard to really address one of the problems that's, you know, contributing to why we have such low test scores and higher dropout rates.
You know, it's interesting, Professor Monroe, that, you know, even with this additional funding, K through 12 education in California is still going to rank relatively low relative to other states in terms of the average cost per student. So is this additional money or new money going to help improve educational attainment in the Valley? What do you think?
Yeah, I think so. And I you know, I agree with what Jeff said, you know, in the sense that there is consistency is the thing that in the end is going to, you know, raise the average over the long term. And when you talk about attainment, you know, I think it brings to mind sort of a longer term set of goals. But I do think that, you know, when you think about what gets cut in really lean times, it is some sort of support services like, you know, social worker or school-based social worker type roles and school counselors and other, you know, special needs, you know, teachers that are sometimes part-time or have to work in several roles. So I do think that money in the short run could make some immediate impact, especially for students that struggle in some of these districts, in a way that you know, you'll see at least performance that gets back up closer to sort of the average of their grade level.
Yeah, you know, Paul, it's interesting that the Prop 30 increase that Governor Brown was successful in getting passed really didn't add any new dollars to education. It kind of just stopped the bleeding. Moreover, it kind of, the dollars that we do have seem to be redistributed to these schools with lots of poor children and English learners, but didn't really add a dime to the overall pot. So what about those middle-class schools like Clovis and others? They're probably not going to be seeing much of an increase.
Some of those schools probably aren't going to need that much increase. The key thing is that they're going to be able to have a better say on what they do with that money and actually have local decision-making on how they use those funds. I agree a lot with what both Nate and Jeff said, especially Jeff when he's talking about, you know, a lot of the barriers to attainment and education in the Valley aren't necessarily money. They are things like the transient population, by a high new immigrant population, English as second language learners, a lack of an educational culture, absenteeism, a lot of those things that money really doesn't address that much.
You know, Paul, I don't know what they have in Visalia in terms of pre-K, but that was a thing that was really championed by the former leader of the Senate, Senate Pro Tem Daryl Steinberg. He thought, you know, he was saying that pre-K education was really a cost-effective educational strategy, particularly when it's directed at at-risk youth. Do you think that the state's improving budget picture is going to make pre-K programs more likely, particularly those targeted at at-risk youth?
Yeah, I do. I think there's a lot of districts that were just looking for the funding and the the opportunity to do that. It is kind of like what Jeff said before, though, or was it Nate? I forget. You know, you got to have a dependable source to set up those programs and make sure they're going to continue. We can think of what happened with, for instance, lower class size, reduced class sizes that's happened in California. You know, they went big for a while, but then the money ran out, and now things are kind of back to where they were.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think both professors are focusing on kind of the long-term revenue stream of predictability. So I'm going to ask them about that. Let me start with Professor Monroe. Let's talk about the revenue picture and how it might relate to this first leg of the high-speed rail system that's being built in the Valley. You know, talk about long-term funding. Is it going to have any effect, do you think?
Well, I think it'll, you know, the effect it's going to have is that, you know, it's going to reduce some of the scrutiny on the, you know, on that project in terms of, you know, seeming like a either wasteful or unnecessary, expenditure, right? I mean, you know, one of the problems with some of that in the midst of budget crises and in the midst of really low revenues for the state is it's something that, you know, is certainly not needed right now. In fact, it can't even be realized right now. And so when there's so many other things being cut, it's hard to invest in sort of future infrastructure. My guess is that it will have an effect in terms of some public opinion, which might allow some of the things that are already looking like they're going to go forward to go forward a little with a little less contention. But I don't, you know, is it going to dramatically speed it up or really change its fate? You know, probably not.
Professor Cummins, you've been a supporter of high-speed rail. Do you think that the improving revenue picture for the state means a brighter picture for high-speed rail?
Well, as Nate was saying, I think it takes pressure off of trying to squeeze, trying to find funding streams for high-speed rail. But in terms of getting more money for high-speed rail, I would say that it's probably not going to happen with the state's revenue picture increasing. They have the High-Speed Rail Commission has the state bonds that were passed. They have the federal money. The governor and legislature committed the cap and trade fees from AB 32 to the high-speed rail system. So that's a pretty significant investment in high-speed rail initially, and I can't really see the legislature or governor pushing for revenue beyond that.
Yeah, you know, Paul, you're in Visalia, a bit of a hotbed in opposition to high-speed rail, at least, you know, Kings County and Tulare County. What do you think? Do you think the picture changes at all with the improved revenue picture, people's attitude toward high-speed rail?
Not really. I think it'll reduce some of the grumbling. I think, as Jeff sort of alluded to, that since they won't be poaching money from the general fund or from other uses, there won't be as much complaining about it. But, you know, high-speed rail is, like, moving along in its inexorable way over obstacles, over different plans, and it just seems to be kind of inevitable.
Yeah. Okay, so Professor Cummins, we've heard a lot about water. It's been a huge issue. Obviously, for the last few years, we've had this drought. Do you think the improved revenue picture is going to increase the likelihood that we'll see new dams faster or movement on the governor's Twin Tunnels project to address water conveyance from the Delta? What do you think?
Yeah, I'm more skeptical on this one, just from the standpoint that the state just passed the water bond on the November ballot. And so it might be viewed that, you know, we just made this significant investment with the bonds, and so we don't need to put additional state money towards it. In terms of the governor's Twin Tunnels project, they're looking at funding that through user fees. Perhaps if, you know, the governor and legislature agree to put more state funding towards that, that would relieve some of the pressure that the users might face in funding that project, but I would say that that's probably doubtful, just given the fact that the state bond passed.
Well, Paul, there's other ways to conserve water or be more efficient with our use of water. One is underground water banking. Do you see more money maybe being allocated to those types of projects given the improved revenue picture for the state?
If there's money left over, we'll do it. But I think I agree with Jeff that a lot of Californians are going to kind of say, okay, we're taking care of that problem. We passed the bond. Okay, things are going to go along. The continuing crisis of water and the persistent drought will definitely put some pressure on the need to take action on these things. So it's going to have to be done one way or the other. It's good that California isn't totally broke right now, and they don't. That excuse isn't the first thing they can say. Oh, we'd do this if we had the money. Well, maybe we do have the money, and maybe we'll get done.
You know, it's interesting. The L.A. Metropolitan Water District has done some pretty innovative things to reduce the use of water by homeowners. One is they've actually encouraged folks to put in artificial lawns in their house, and they've incentivized that by providing money. So, Professor Monroe, do you think we're going to see more of that around the state, where maybe the state might help provide funding for people to take out some of their lawns to conserve water?
Yeah, I do. And actually, the place that there's going to be a lot of that, I mean, you know, is in agriculture. And, you know, they're going to be, I think, a lot of state funding to try to incentivize ways for sort of more efficient use of water in ag. And, you know, I think there's some debates about what exactly, is more efficient, or, you know, and there's some trade-offs in that. But, you know, that's where, you know, the other side of it is that a lot of, you know, not only homeowners, but agriculture have improvements that could be made, and that I think the state could easily sort of provide some funding to try to support.
It'd be interesting to see if that happens. Go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Paul Rose. I can see that happening already in this area. You see a lot more farmers putting in drip irrigation and other innovative ways to get the water in their crops rather than just flooding fields. You also see some innovative things in municipal government, such as the trade-off between treated water for the city of Visalia from its water treatment plant with the Tulare Irrigation District. Mm-hmm. They will swap water so that the irrigation district can use treated water to its ag customers, while the city of Visalia will get potable water from the irrigation district. So there's some innovative things that are already happening out there. And, you know, it's not taking a lot of state money to do them either.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see what happens in that regard. Let me switch to topics again. There's always a need for money in different places. One is prisons and jails. So we've got realignment with the increase of the what's called the three nons, the non-serious, non-violent, non-sexual felons who are doing their time either in county jails or on county probation instead of state prison or state parole. Do you think the additional revenue might be sent to help some of these cash-strapped Valley counties to deal with these new responsibilities under realignment? What do you think, Paul?
No, I don't see it happening. The state prison system is such a mess, I think that the state is going to try to concentrate on correcting that. It seems clear from AB 39, I forget what the number is, that it's now it's 2 years down the road. It's kind of working. Yes, local governments have been complaining about it, but they're dealing with it. I don't see the legislature offering any relief there.
Professor Monroe, do you think that the state might come to the rescue of some of these counties that are really cash strapped and they're seeing, you know, now overcapacity in their county jails?
In the short run, I don't think they will. I do think that, you know, there'll be some buildup over time where if the revenue continues, I think if we see 3 or 4 years of, you know, significant improvement in revenue to the state and maybe even sort of start to see, you know, something that looks like surpluses, then I think we may, you know, that'll be the point, you know, 3 or 4 years from now at which they begin to reverse that. But, you know, this is something that I think, you know, the state's not anxious, I think, to come in and bail out the counties and that's in terms of jailing the nons, as you put it.
Yeah.
And I just don't see there, you know, there's going to be some significant sort of some more desperation and some changes in the way that people view sort of crime rates, for example, that causes sort of public outcry for this.
Yeah, there's been a series of reports by the Public Policy Institute of California indicating that policing is a more effective crime control strategy than incarceration. So, Professor Cummins, what do you think, that maybe the state might give the counties a little more assistance to hire more police officers, or cities more assistance to hire more police officers? Is that possible?
Well, you know, I would say that when we start getting to the non-education areas, we talked about how a significant portion of the funding is going to go to K through 12. There's not going to be a whole lot of money left over in the next year or two for the non-education programs, including the realignment programs in the counties. So, you know, we're not talking about billions of dollars here that's going to go. In terms of, will the counties get some of this money? Maybe a little bit, but probably only if you start to hear a lot more stories about how convicted criminals who would have been serving more time in jail or out in the community and committing crimes.
Right.
Aside from that, I can't really see the pressure to put more money into the realignment programs. And then on top of that, just as the state's revenue picture is improving, so are the county's revenue picture.
Good point.
Improving as well. Property taxes and sales taxes are increasing too. So there's less pressure to get money from the state then.
Okay. Well, when we come back, we'll continue our discussion about the state's improving financial picture and what it may mean for the Valley. That conversation in a moment.
From News Talk 580-1059 KMJ, this is the Matty Report, Valley Views Edition. Here is Mark Kepler.
Welcome back. We're talking about the state's improving revenue picture and what it may or may not mean for the Valley with UC Merced political science professor Nate Monroe, former editorial page editor of the Visalia Times Delta, Paul Hurley, and California State University Fresno political science professor Jeff Cummins. So, Professor Cummins, let me ask you this. There are a lot of programs that benefit the poor that were cut during the Great Recession. First, what is the likelihood that the improved revenue picture is going to mean that some of these programs are going to be restored? And second, are there any programs that, if they're restored, could potentially have a significant impact on the Valley?
Yeah, I mean, in terms of the first question, I would say there's going to be a lot of pressure from the legislature and outside advocates to provide more welfare support, perhaps even support for community colleges, which help retrain workers. I could see a lot of emphasis placed on increasing the monthly welfare payments, you know, for the CalWORKs program, as well as other programs. And in terms of just what programs could potentially impact the Valley, you know, I would say both of those. The welfare is certainly going to help lower-income areas. If we put more funding into community colleges, that's going to help train workers as well. And then, you know, we can also go back to K through 12 education. You know, the more emphasis we place on education, that's only going to help people get jobs and so on.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, Paul, I'm going to ask you about this: the rainy day fund proposal that the voters passed in November. It's more robust than the one that existed prior to the November election, but it had a limit on how much a school district could carry forward as a reserve, which is kind of interesting. Normally, Governor Brown very much wants to let locals make their own decisions, but they had this unique provision in that proposal. What are the implications for Valley school districts? What do you think?
Well, Valley school district, at least the superintendents I've talked to, are kind of upset with Governor Brown for this because he's advocating a rainy day fund for himself, but won't let school districts have it. And certainly schools believe that they need a cushion, and they probably do. If they don't have that cushion and they are not able to build up a revenue, a surplus fund, a rainy day fund, it's going to be harder and harder to start new programs. It's going to be more difficult to negotiate with their labor groups because they're not going to have that cushion. It's going to be harder to predict what your resources are going to be 2 or 3 years down the line. So I think that is probably going to change. I think some wiser heads are going to come in there and realize that school districts need that leeway.
Well, UC professor, UC Merced professor Nate Monroe, let me ask you this. You know, you've got this, it seems like they want to free up more money at the local districts. Maybe for what Paul's talking about in terms of using it at the bargaining table to increase teacher pay or maybe shoring up the CalSTRS, the teacher pension fund. Is this money going to get siphoned off as a result of these other purposes?
Well, it certainly could. I mean, you know, one of the things that they've really struggled to do is to be able to, I think, establish, you know, contracts with teachers and with unions, both in terms of retirement and in terms of teacher pay, that, you know, are satisfactory. And so as a result, right, there's been, you know, enormous tension over the last 4 or 5 years between the, you know, statewide, between the teachers union, especially in some of the areas of the Valley. And so, you know, I think, you know, and I think probably it's an important thing to do because, you know, as Jeff mentioned earlier, right, I mean, without consistency, and part of that is, I think, consistency in terms of what teachers are wanting, running what programs, you know, it's very hard to sort of improve the situation at any at a school, and especially at schools that are struggling or that have a lot of lower income or Spanish or English as second language students. And so I think that some of that money will sort of, in some sense, be siphoned off, but probably toward the end of creating some more consistency in the labor situation.
Okay, let me change focus a little bit here, Professor Monroe. Let me ask you about this the election and the fact that the Democrats no longer enjoy a supermajority, two-thirds supermajority in the California legislature. It means they're going to have to negotiate with Republicans like Assembly Minority Leader Kristen Olson from Modesto, your area. So what does that mean in terms of Governor Brown? In the final analysis, is he going to be able to hold the line on new spending and focus the state's new revenues on addressing California's long-term liabilities, which he's talked about, that wall of debt? Or will the temptation be too great to spend that money? What do you think?
Well, I guess, you know, there's a couple parts to that, and I'll try to be quick. But, you know, first, you know, the two-thirds part is, you know, as I think we've talked about in other segments, the two-thirds part is only relevant now if we're trying to raise revenue. And, you know, given that what we're really talking about is spending decisions primarily here, you know, in some sense it doesn't matter very much, right, the sort of whether it's just this side or just that side of the two-thirds majority, especially when you have a governor that's Democrat and a majority in both chambers that are Democrats, right, the two-thirds only comes into play then in addition when there's a veto, right? So it really is about Brown negotiating with the Democrats and them with internally figuring out a spending package that Brown doesn't feel compelled to veto and the Democrats don't feel compelled to try to override. But in terms of, you know, unless we're trying to raise new revenues, which, you know, the Democrats may want to do at times, there's not a lot of need for negotiation in that sense. But I do think that, you know, very quickly, I do think that Brown will probably hold the line. I mean, he's sort of shown in his first administration, or so this is most recent administration, that, you know, he's kind of stuck to that plan and done things that I think are pretty fiscally conservative in general.
Well, Fresno State political science professor Jeff Cummins, what do you think? A lot of pressure here to restore some of these cuts that have occurred in the past, or is Brown going to be successful, like Professor Monroe seems to indicate, in kind of keeping the focus on paying down our debts?
Well, just to address the two-thirds majority, you know, I agree with Nate. It doesn't really matter. And in, you know, as they've already tackled the water bond, for instance, where you need a two-thirds vote, there's fewer and fewer issues where they need that two-thirds vote. But the really big one that's going to come up in the next couple of years and over Brown's second term here is doing something with taxes, either extending Proposition 30 or doing some sort of major tax reform. And so if Brown wants to do that, he is going to need a two-thirds majority, a supermajority to do that. So in terms of, you know, is he going to increase spending? His pattern has been to advocate publicly for holding the line, but then usually when it gets down to the actual budget negotiations, he gives in a little to the legislative leaders on their pet programs.
Well, Paul Hurley, you've been watching state politics for a long time as the former editorial page editor of the Visalia Times Delta. What are your thoughts on this? What's going to happen going forward? Temptation going to be too great to spend that money by the legislature?
Well, let me offer a radical view here, and that is that the Republicans, that Governor Brown is actually going to find a stronger ally among Republicans in the legislature than Democrats. especially in things like tax reform, in spending on infrastructure, and in some of his fiscally conservative policies, in cutting spending and reducing the size of government. And so I agree with the other two that I don't think the two-thirds majority is supermajority is going to matter that much, but for a different reason. I think Brown's going to find enough allies in the Republican Party to go along with some other conservative Democrats to promote his agenda.
It sounds like it's going to be more intra-organizational bargaining than inter-organizational. It's going to be between the Democrats and the legislature and the governor, it sounds like. Well, I want to thank our guests, UC political science professor Nate Monroe, former editorial page editor of the Isaiah Times Delta, Paul Hurley, and California State University Fresno political science professor Jeff Cummins for joining us. If you want to keep up to date with state and local politics, you can sign up for our free e-newsletter, The Matty Daily, by just logging on to our website at mattyinstitute.org.
The Matty Report Valley Views Edition is a public affairs partnership between KMJ Radio and the nonpartisan Matty Institute, providing the Valley with valuable insight and analysis on important public policy issues.
This is Mark Kepler for the Matty Report Valley Views Edition. Thanks for joining us.